And welcome back to Coast AM, where we take your calls, your near-death experience stories. Share them with us when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. John, okay, we talked a little bit about hell, but what about the devil? Where is the devil under all of this?
Well, one person told me about his personal experience with the devil. He was raised in a family that was completely involved in drugs. They grew their own marijuana in the backyard, and he made the mistake of telling his teacher about this one day, and the family kind of got broken up at that point. He was raised in the whole drug milieu. He didn't know anything else but that. He found a sweet young girl, married her, got her hooked on drugs, got their children hooked on drugs, got her children hooked on drugs. He was a pusher, and he ruined, you know, many, many, many lives. And then it all came crashing down for him, and he decided to commit suicide, and did so the Japanese harikiri style, with a knife.
Right in his gut.
Yeah, right. And the next thing he knew, he is in hell. It's like he's been strapped against a wall, and this Tyrannosaurus Rex type individual with claws is raking him down the front with deep wounds and all the pain that's associated with it, and then steps back and he's healed. He's back together again, and then he comes at him again with the talons and tears him apart. And this is going on and on and on. And then suddenly that creature stepped back in fright, and a very imposing figure came in and said, because you have done this, you're going to be here forever. You're going to be separated from me forever, and went on. And he thought that was God. And I said, no. The devil cannot tell the truth, and he cannot do anything loving. And so if he told you he was God, then that is an absolute lie. And in any event, in the next moment, he starts yelling out, help me, Lord, help me, Lord. Blink, he's out of there, and he's in a hospital. And he turned his life around. I met him in prison, because I've been very involved in a wonderful prison ministry program called Kairos.
What was it called?
Kairos. That's the Greek word for the right time, God's own time.
Okay.
And he told me about his experience. He got out of prison. I've helped him get his life straightened out again, and he's doing very well, and he's now a very kind, sweet, loving person, energetic about helping people. But in a session with him, I was able to point out to him that that couldn't have been God, because he told a lie. You're going to be separated from me forever, and he calls out, Lord, help me, and he's out of there. So there's the first lie that he told. Second lie that the devil told him was, because you've done this, you're going to be separated from me. Well, that wasn't the case. He's not separated from God, and he's back with God. Each of the people who had distressing or hellish experiences, when they said, Jesus, help me, or Lord, help me, blink, they were out of there.
But they really have to mean it.
Well, yeah. But if you're being treated like that, you're meaning it. Well, let me come back to that and say, no, not entirely. Howard Storm wrote this excellent book, My Descent into Death. I've already mentioned it.
Right.
In it, he told about his experience that he stepped up out of his body. Somebody at the door was saying, come on with us. And so he's walking down the hallway, and it's not the hallway of the hospital. He's walking down this hallway with him, and they start pulling at him and tearing body parts off, as he put it. And he starts screaming, and here's this atheist, And suddenly he says, God. Well, it's a cultural exclamation, of course. But at that point, the demons stepped back and screamed at him, there is no God, there is no God. He suddenly realized that he had some kind of power over them by saying religious words. So here's this atheist trying to think of all the religious words he's ever heard. And finally, when he calls out, Jesus, help me, because he'd heard that phrase someplace, all of a sudden, Jesus came in like a meteor and scattered the demons, picked him up, and walked away with him. The torment was over when he called on the Lord. And that is what is in common with these people who were out of there.
Let's take some calls here with you, John.
Sure,
let's pick it up by going to Joe in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Hey,
go ahead.
George, how you doing? Haven't spoke with you
good.
For a long time. How you doing, John?
Yes,
John, when you're through, tell us what ministry and how we can call you or write to you. I'd like to challenge some of your things. I've lost a lot of faith in God. I forgot to tell Tom I'm going to Lourdes for a healing.
Oh, good. Let us know what happens.
Yes, yeah. I'm going 27th to the 6th of July. I'm going to ask for a call out. John, you say suicide is wrong. I disagree with you respectfully. You know, we can disagree and still be friends.
Okay.
I know people that have suffered hell. I've gone through a lot myself. I have felt this way. If things don't get better, I may not be around. That's how I feel. I don't think it's wrong because no, we're not put here to suffer. Like a lot of people say, oh, you've got to go through this, go through that. People that are mistreated in hospitals, that are not given treatment like they're supposed to. And also, that's my first thing. And my other question was, how do you explain this to people that say, I forgot it, but I'll make another one, that you're going to hell if you don't follow the rules of the church?
And, I've got a story that will speak directly to that, if you let me tell it.
Sure.
I was put in contact with this guy through the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, for whom I am a pastoral consultant. And they send people to me, and they put him and me together. And he was operating a travel agency. I think it was in St. Louis.
I love one of my hometowns.
And he had four men who were working for him as travel agents. And one night, those four men were all killed in a car wreck where a drunk ran a red light, smashed into him, killed him, and killed the drunk. Well, with all this workload of those four guys suddenly on him, the boss, he overworked himself, and he had not one but three fatal heart attacks in a row.
It was too much for him.
Yeah, exactly. And as he was going back in, the first time that he went in to heaven, in the first experience, there were all his loved ones greeting him, and the four travel agents greeted him, and the drunk who killed him, because they'd forgiven the drunk. Now, the next thing you need to know in this, and this you can find this account in the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website, nderf.org, he tells that those four travel agents were all gay and active gays. So there's the first point to make, and there's a book out by Dr. Liz Dale, who tells about 21 different accounts of lesbians and homosexuals who, homosexual men, who had the beautiful experience, not a hellish experience. So there's kind of the first point to get out of this. Second point to get out of it speaks directly to what you were talking about. The second time he was going into heaven, he realized there were all these souls floating around outside, not going in. And he inquired, why can't they come in? And he was told, they can. They don't think they can. In other words, they'd been told repeatedly in their lives that they were so bad they were going to go to hell. Well, they weren't that bad. They didn't go to hell. And now they're afraid to go into heaven. And Jesus talked about the sin against the Holy Spirit being the one unforgivable sin. I've always taken that to mean denying that you can be forgiven, and that as soon as you quit denying, you can be forgiven. Well, here were all these people that were afraid to go in. Well, who committed the sin against the Holy Spirit? Well, them, but as well, all those religious authorities, parents, teachers, etc., who had told them, you're going to hell because you're a bad person.
But you seem to imply, John, if I'm reading this right, that some suicide victims sent back changed their lives.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, for one thing, they know not to commit suicide anymore for the kinds of problems that they had. Now, I have never spoken with anyone who committed suicide because they were, say, dying of an intractable disease, trying to get away from it. So all I can know is what these people have come back and told me. And no, I have never spoken with anybody who committed suicide because of an intractable pain of, say, terminal cancer. I remember my mother and any one of a number of people went through that. I felt so sorry for them and the incredible pain that they were going through, and that death was going to be the only release from it. I know there are states that have enabled doctor-assisted suicide. I don't know how I feel about that. I know that, generally speaking, suicide is not an answer to temporary problems.
Well, I've always told people it's always brighter. And, you know, for that moment of darkness, John, that people are going through, incredible darkness, I'm sure, that, you know, if you just hold on, things could get better for you.
Yeah.
And if you jump off too soon, you're never going to find out.
Exactly.
You know, I do, however, want to get your take on suicide based on incredible pain. You know, what Kevorkian would do for people, but for example.
Yes, I know. I don't have a solid answer for you from these accounts.
I mean, I'm going to tell you a bizarre story. Right after Thanksgiving, I burned my throat in my mouth.
Huh.
Stupid way to do it, but I did. And it was difficult breathing and swallowing that night.
Gosh,
I actually thought, you know what, I'm going to die this way. What a way to go. And though I've never contemplated suicide, I can understand how people who are pushed to the limit in terms of that kind of stress or pain could simply say, it's not worth it to me. I don't look at that as a depressed person, but if you're really in excruciating pain, you know what?
10 pain on a scale of 1 to 10, level 10 pain.
Yeah, level 10 pain.
I was there one time. It was a kidney stone. My word, that thing was awful.
I had one in 1982.
Isn't it terrible?
It's the worst.
Yep.
It's like a little spike in your system.
My mother said she gave birth to 3 children, and she had a kidney stone, and the kidney stone was far more painful than the birth of children.
Well, now that they at least have ultrasounds and they can bombard the thing.
Yeah, right.
In those days, they didn't.
Yep.
Either to pass it or they cut it out.
Yep.
I think I was taking too much vitamin C, they said.
if you're taking old, that's where mine came from, was taking old vitamin C.
Yep.
When vitamin C degrades,
in the beginning, that's
in age, it becomes oxalic acid, which reforms as kidney stone.
That's right. And you were taking, I bet, 2,000 milligrams a day, maybe?
Oh, more than that.
Uh-huh.
And I'd bought a big container of it, and it was more than a year old. I've learned the hard way right there.
There you go. Let's go to first-time caller. We've got J.K. in Rattlesnake Mountain, Oklahoma, first-time caller. Hi, J.K.
Hi, George. Good thoughts, good words,
you
good
too.
Deed.
You
Rattlesnake
too.
Hi, John.
Mike.
Hi, John. I'm your neighbor in Oklahoma.
What a wonderful name. Rattlesnake Mountain, that's as good as Cut and Shoot, Texas, which is just north of Houston.
I am a 70-year-old practicing registered nurse, among other things.
Yes.
When I was 23 years old, I had an experience. Must have been something very similar to yours, because the words you've used are the same words I've used. But that's not what I want to talk about. I called because I have spent my life trying to understand and get confirmation for that experience. And in doing so, the nursing degree didn't do it. So I went back to school and got a degree in psychology. That didn't do it. So I did a master's degree in Jungian psychology through a cultural anthropology work. And in that program, I met William James, father of American psychology.
The variety of religious
experience. He wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience.
Terrific book.
Read the book. My confirmation was solid. And I have to tell you that everything I have done since that time, every decision I've made has been based on my experience when I was 23. I would like to hear your comments about the book published in 1902.
What was
about the varieties.
What was your experience, J.K.?
Oh, I can't talk about that. I don't have the words for that.
All right.
But I would like to know what your comments on the book, Varieties of Religious Experience, and how that may have helped you to understand what the subject is tonight.
Well, James had such terrific insights and such magnificent ability to articulate them. I was deeply impressed by the book, and I'd have to say that it helped me a whole lot to get over the technical, rational, scientific milieu that I was raised in, and realize that there's got to be more. And it helped strengthen my faith a lot. It did. But still, I had my own doubts, and that were somewhat taken care of by that book. It didn't have as much impact on me as it did on you. But you'd been seeking and searching, and how many years was it before you came across James's book?
Must have been at least a couple, at least.
Are you still there, ma'am?
No, she's not.
Oh, okay. That's really a very important book. I need to go back and read it again. I'm sure that I would get a whole lot more out of it now than I did the first time that I read it.
Do you hold any special, concerns for people who have died and have come back?
Yes. So many of them are very reluctant to talk about it, because they get scoffed at, or they're afraid of being scoffed at again, or being told that this is of the devil. And on that subject, I find it fascinating, because I hear that a lot, that this is a program put forward by the devil to fool the elect.
To trick people, yeah.
Well, my response to that is, I find it very strange that the devil has a program that when you go through it, you emerge the other side convinced that God is loving.
It's failing. It's not working for the devil. John, stay with us. We're going to come back with you in just a moment, and we'll take some more calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Many positive outcomes of near-death experiences as people have come back. It's changed their lives. More with Reverend John W. Price on Coast to Coast AM. With John Price. John, how do you explain ghosts? We kicked on that for just a little bit. But, you know, if these near-death experiences are real, and we all believe they are, what are the ghosts?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. George Ritchie told in his book about his experience of dying from pneumonia in an army hospital in 1943. And he said that he had been planning on going into San Antonio from Fort Bliss. And the doctor said, no, you're going to stay in that bed. And they took his clothes away so that he couldn't leave. Well, he decided he was going to get up and leave. And so he got up in his hospital gown. And an orderly, he couldn't find his clothes. An orderly was walking through, and he tried to get the orderly to tell him where his clothes were. And the orderly walked right through him. And he thought, What is
Whoa.
This? And he went back, and he saw himself in the bed. He didn't realize it was him. He said, somebody's in my bed. He went up and looked and realized was him. Now, consider someone, there is a ghost in a particular building in Galveston, Texas, that I gave a series of lectures in. And after about the third lecture, the staff got to know me, and they decided to tell me about their ghost and asked me if I'd heard about their ghost. I had not. I said, tell me. I said, this woman keeps walking through here, and she's wearing period dress from about 1900.
And they all see her.
And they all see her. Now, 1900, Galveston, that was the huge storm that was the worst natural disaster ever to hit the United States.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Thousands of people died, many thousands. And she keeps walking through saying, they're coming for me, they're coming for me. Now, I've spent a lot of time seeing film clips from Galveston immediately after the hurricane that Edison came down and shot, and reading books about this, because I've been, you know, living on the Texas coast, I've been through quite a few hurricanes, and whole buildings fell over and collapsed. Well, if you're then killed and your soul steps out of the body and you don't get to see your body, you can be unaware that you are dead, because that's the experience that so many of these people had. They were astounded to learn that they were dead. There was a couple of movies that pick up on this theme, and those movies were pretty darn accurate about the process of being quite a while before they realized they were dead.
And that was you. That storm killed, they think, between 6,000 and 12,000 people.
Correct.
Back in 1900, wasn't it?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. September.
It was a hurricane.
Yeah. Worst. It was a Category 5 hurricane.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So the ghosts hang around.
They hang around, and I think in one respect that's one understanding that I have, one explanation that I have for what a ghost is, that it's the soul who's hung around. Now, why do some people see this ghost and others do not? We had an 1870 age building on our church property in Austin, and there was a little girl who was murdered there. After the church had taken over this property and was using it as office and Sunday school space. And this girl was murdered in the middle of the week when very few people were around, and they built one building and dedicated it to her. Well, I went back years after I had left that church and went over to that building, which was now houses a nonprofit organization that helps children who have HIV. HIV positive. And after we talked about the building for a while and what they were doing in it, they said, tell us about the ghost. And I said, ghost? I don't know anything about a ghost here. They said, oh, yes, she's a little girl, and her name is Margaret, and she comes walking through, and she talks to us. I said, Margaret, 8 years old? There's a building out there that's in her memory. She was killed in this building. Now, why is she hanging around? I don't know. I immediately began praying for her to realize that she's dead and for her to go on to heaven. That's been my approach whenever I've come to a place where the people that are living there are having troubles with their ghosts, is to go and pray earnestly that this person realize that they're dead and go on to heaven. It's a very important point.
It sure is. Let's take some more calls. Julie's in Sacramento. Go ahead, Julie.
John and George.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had three experiences, one when I was five, another one when I was six, another one when I was 31. And I did go on to become an ICRM. And taking everything that I've learned so far about the after-death experiences, all the people that come back always look downward at their body, not sideways, not from the bottom. And then taking that a little bit further, learning from physics that the energy charge never dies, just changes form, retaining its property, taking nursing and medicine to a different level, There is an EKG and an EEG that measures the electrical charge within the body. When that line flatlines, we die. And then taking the positive and negatives of science, where the negative repel and the positive and negative attract. If God is a positive and the body is a negative, and God is a very strong positive, then when we die, that energy charge goes towards God.
That's an interesting insight. Thank you.
And with my three experiences, my first one was at 5 years old when I drowned. And I told my parents afterwards that a beautiful woman with wings had lit up the bottom and told me to crawl. And I was seeing my body, a little girl wearing my clothes. And the next thing I knew, I was watching my dad jumping up and down in the lake and or the river. And the second experience, I was in an accident and laid in a coma for 3 days. And when I came back, my dad was looking at me with tears in his eyes and asked me what had happened. And I was very angry because the man had stopped me from going into the beautiful light. And I could not come until I was 31, in my 30s, and I was going to become an Army nurse. And I, from that moment on, I knew that I was going to become an Army nurse. I did become an Army medic. And at 31, my husband, in his non-boiling rage robotic flashback, strangled me, left me for dead.
Oh, jeez.
And a beautiful angel stopped me from going into the most beautiful light. And as a nurse, I worked on the oncology, hematology floor, and I talked to the patients about how beautiful death was. Did have one of the patients that was breathing her last, and she suddenly opened her eyes, looked, her face just looked just glorious with this look of, she was looking into heaven,
right.
And smiled, and just one tear rolled down her right cheek, and she was gone. And she had the most peaceful look on her face.
Yeah.
So that is what I have learned about it. And when you flatline, you know that energy is the spirit. And there's only one way for it to go, and that's to heaven, whether you die from suicide or a heart attack or illness or an injury. I totally believe that.
Well, I'm glad you're still around here, yes. Julie.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
It's a great story. When did you get convinced, John, that the other side exists? Was it because you were interviewed so many people?
Oh no. It was that one soldier.
He did it.
I call him Private Alberto. I've got a chapter in my book about Private Alberto, who Raymond Moody's, I had just read Raymond
Moody's book
the previous month and thought, well, I'm wondering if this is real. And this sounds like what these people were trying to tell me, but then it got slam dunked for me when the next month I talked to, I call him Private Alberto because I don't remember his name, but he was a Mexican-American. And he was very humble about what he was telling me. I could tell instantly he was not trying to pull the wool over my eyes. He was very grateful to me for getting him out of the jam that he was in. And driving him home to San Antonio. And that's why, out of that gratitude, he told me. Now, the lady who just called is a good example of the way that I've collected so many, if you could call it that, so many accounts, is that I've learned that when I talk about these things, people come up and say, I had that experience, and here's what happened to me.
I would say 60-75% of the people have had something like that happen.
Well, that's interesting. George Gallup did a survey in 1981 on this very thing because he was familiar with Moody's book, and he wanted to see. So he went to his random sample of Americans, and he found 18% of the American population in 1981 had what he called a verge of death experience. But they were able, they were able to write down what some comments about their experience, and it was very clearly it was the near-death experiences that they were having. Gallup published that the next year. Now, think of all the advances in medical science in the last 32 years. I wish that the Gallup organization, George is dead, I wish that the Gallup organization would do that study again to see if it's changed. Now, and right here is an important point. One of the reasons we're hearing about so many of these is not just that Raymond Moody made it acceptable to talk about this. There was a big change, a paradigm shift, if you will, in ambulances in the 1960s. Prior to the 1960s, if you're old enough to remember back then, an ambulance was simply a sort of a inelegant hearse that funeral homes provided as a service to the community. And it would be arrive with a driver, no staff, no, maybe it had a first aid kit, but no oxygen or anything like that. Then, following military medicine brought into civilian medicine, the concept of having a rolling ER. And that's what those ambulances are today. You don't see the old type at all. In 1967, I was on active duty at Fort Dix, and
tough. That's a tough spot.
It was a tough spot, and we were running the infiltration course, where you crawl 110 yards on your belly in the sand, with 30 caliber machine gun bullets going overhead, and we ran it one time, and then we were fed a heavy meal. Now, we were fed a heavy meal before we ran it, right? Steak and potatoes, and then we crawled the 110 yards, 100 meters, and came out of that, and we were told, okay, now you're going to go back, and we're going to do it all over again. This one fellow who was with us shouldn't have been. He staggered around, and he fell over and turned blue, and some guys there who'd been trained as EMSs leaped on him and started doing CPR, and brought him back a couple of times, but he died. And 20 minutes later, the old-style ambulance drives up without siren, not going fast, and there's only a driver, and there's no staff, and there's no oxygen. And the guy was probably already dead, but if he there was no chance of him being resuscitated in that ambulance. And that just demonstrates the change that was going on. We were all disgusted because we came from civilian settings where there were rolling ERs for ambulances, and the guy had no chance of resuscitation in that. But that's happening now, and happening so frequently. I have several friends who were resuscitated in ambulances on the way to the hospital, and that's another reason there's so many more near-death experiences to be related these days. And I sure wish that Gallup would do that study again.
Oh, it'd be even higher.
Yeah, I think
it'd be. No question.
Yeah.
Let's go to Bob in Cumberland, Maryland. Thanks for calling, Bob. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you?
Okay.
And Reverend John, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad you called.
Well, thank you. I was just sitting here in my chair with my dog at my feet, and you said something that made me call you, and I had a massive stroke about 3 years ago, and I was unconscious, and everyone was standing around, and they're all thinking the worst, you know, that I was going to be a vegetable the rest of my life, et cetera, et cetera. And then they left the room, and It's not your time yet came through from somewhere.
Yes.
And I opened my eyes, which I never could do because they were paralyzed. I was conscious underneath all of this, but I couldn't move.
Yep.
And my eyes opened. And the voice that said it to me, I have not related this to anyone but you and 30 million other people now.
You're listening in. Yes, go ahead.
But I had this voice in my head come to me and said, it's not your time yet, Bob. And I woke up. And when you said that, you said those very words. And I'm going, wow, someone else has heard that too. I'm not the only one. Maybe I'm not crazy.
No, all these people are told that it's not your time yet.
Yeah.
And
that blew me away. And And I worked feverishly from that time on to become normal as I could be.
Yeah, good for you.
I was in the hospital about 6 months, and they, because of that sentence that was said to me, I listened to all the nurses who, by the way, I hated at the time, but I love today. They did terrific, terrific work. But they got me walking and speaking. I couldn't talk. I talked fluent Spanish, although I couldn't speak English, but I thought I was speaking English, but I wasn't. I was talking Spanish. So they brought in a Spanish interpreter. So that, you know, because I knew Spanish from prior time, and it was the weirdest experience of my life.
That's interesting that you couldn't speak English, but you could speak Spanish after this.
Those who do die, John, do you think they merely say to them, you aren't going back?
Well, may I remind you that the bulk of them are not happy at having to be back.
Well, that's true. I don't know why. I think life is precious, but you're right.
Well, see, now there's another change that's going to happen to you, George, as you read more of these accounts and listen to these people. You realize it's up. It is infinitely better on the other side. But don't rush it.
But don't rush it.
Yeah.
I'm in no hurry.
Okay, good.
To get there.
Hey, you got work to do here.
That's right.
Mark Twain said, if you've ever wondered whether there's something left for you to do or not, there's a very simple question. Are you still alive?
That's a good point.
Isn't it, though?
That is a good point indeed. John, stay with us. We're going to come back more. I want to get into your book now, Revealing Heaven. Tell us a little bit of how you structured it and how you wrote it, and we'll take final phone calls with you when we make the turn here and come right back on Coast to Coast AM with John W. Price, Revealing Heaven.